Welcome back to Creative Therapy Umbrella. This is a place where we talk about all different types of creative arts therapies, expressive therapies, and creative approaches to therapy. Today's episode is no different, as we have Alyssa Wilkins, who is a board-certified music therapist, on. And Alyssa dives into a really amazing topic, and it's supporting neurodiverse and twice exceptional clients in your sessions. And what's great about this episode is Alyssa has something she calls tangibles and takeaways in this episode, and I love that. That's something that I really always strive for in our episodes, that you have something to walk away with so that you can kind of immediately put into place, whether it's listening to someone else's experience, actual kind of intervention ideas. Sometimes it's approach kind of ideas or theoretical ideas that you can apply. But that's something that I really hope our episodes do. And Alyssa does this beautifully in this one. So, she shares some of her insight working as a music therapist and as a specialist in supporting neurodiversity. So Alyssa is a board-certified music therapist, but she's also a certified yoga teacher, and she's absolutely an incredibly passionate autism provider. So she takes a very holistic approach in her work. She's incredibly determined and so compassionate as well, and she's created her own therapeutic center called Dynamic Links. She's a graduate of the University of Miami. She studied music therapy, music education, and psychology there. And she says that her passion really lies in early intervention for children with autism and providing the best therapeutic services possible to help all individuals reach their fullest potential. So this episode is jam-packed. It was just so lovely talking with Alyssa and hearing her perspective and all the different things she does have for you to take away from this episode was just phenomenal. So I'm really excited for this one, to get out there and for you guys to take away whatever you can take away from it. So I hope you guys enjoy it, and I will talk to you on the other side. All right, Alyssa, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
Yes, thanks for being here and taking the time on this holiday week to just kind of talk with us about all the awesome stuff that you do.
Yeah, I'm super excited. I love podcasts, and I think this is going to be a really good one, I hope.
I think it's going to be amazing, too. And this is a topic that is, not that any of the topics are not near and dear to my heart, but this one's very near and dear to my heart. So I'm really excited to hear you talk about your specialties. So, So for our listeners, can you tell us a little bit about what you specialize in with regards to music therapy?
Sure. So I run a private practice, Dynamic Links, and we specialize in empowering neurodiverse individuals, specifically those with autism, ADHD, anxiety, and other mental health needs, and twice exceptional individuals. So I feel like that's a word that's kind of evolved over the last few years. So those are individuals who are gifted, but also have maybe learning challenges or social learning challenges or other diagnoses. So they're twice exceptional. They have two different kind of tiers of needs that we might be accessing. And at Dynamic Links, we use a client-centered approach to therapy. I specifically use a lot of NMT, so I pull that in with other therapeutic frameworks, such as the developmental ladder, often associated with DIR floor time, social thinking, zones of regulation, and other evidence-based protocols that might benefit the clients or groups as we're assessing them. The beauty of our team is that we bring diverse therapy backgrounds to treatment, so we're able to match the client with the clinician based on those areas of need. And we know the effectiveness of therapy often lies in that rapport and relationship building. So that's a lot of what we're going to talk about today when we're talking about neurodiversity and these individuals who have exceptionalities that might not fit into the quote unquote norm.
Yeah. I love that emphasis on relationship, especially with, I know that it's something that is really talked a lot about in a kind of more traditional mental health settings. And as music therapists too, it's definitely something that's talked about, but in relation specifically to children with exceptionalities, who are twice exceptional, children with developmental differences, it's not talked about as much, I feel like, in those arenas as frequently. Yeah. And it's really exciting to hear how much you guys are bringing that to the forefront.
Yeah, I think It's sad that that's not a discussion because so much of therapy lies in that relationship. I can't remember the music therapist. So if you're listening and it's you, feel free to comment on this podcast. Yes. It's a video I watched years ago and the quote just stuck with me that the mode of a traditional talk therapist is talking. The mode of the music therapist is music. But the power doesn't necessarily lie in talking with your psychotherapist. And sometimes the power doesn't lie in the music, in music therapy, but it's the delivering agent of that intervention and of that therapeutic change, which is you, the therapist. So we're using music as the tool, but we are so much the driver of that connection with our client. And when we're talking about that in the neurodiversity space, that has a lot of power. Just like when we're talking about in trauma, what that can mean for you driving the session for the client. So I think understanding your relationship, understanding your biases, understanding transference, countertransference, all those words is still really important in the neurodiversity space as much as it is in more the mental health space when where people might think about it traditionally.
Yes, that is such a great quote. I love that. And that the visual that you kind of painted with that too is just so helpful for, I think, some, you know, especially younger therapists, you know, therapists who have just graduated or students, you know, thinking about there's so much emphasis on what we're doing in sessions, which obviously is incredibly important.
Absolutely.
Yeah. But then remembering that, like, you are a huge part of the therapeutic process. Like, yeah. You as a human bring so much, like, you're driving or you're in the vehicle, however it's working, if it's child-led, therapist-led, whatever, you're in a car together, but you are in that car and your presence is part of that therapeutic change.
Absolutely. And even in a client-centered approach, because I would argue that's at the forefront of what we do, that you're still the person implementing the therapeutic intervention. So you have such an important role and you're the expert, right? Families and clients are coming to you because you have that knowledge. So you have to be aware of the power that you wield when you're in that driver's seat.
Yes. So that power dynamic that you just mentioned, that is an incredibly important thing for therapists to remember, especially in relation to neurodiversity. So as for therapists, what is something that we need to be aware of what that power dynamic means in the therapeutic relationship within working with neurodiverse clients?
Absolutely. I think the first thing we have to understand is what neurodiversity really means in the therapy space and in the world at large. So it's a term that's become more popular over the years. I definitely don't feel like I learned about neurodiversity in my college education, and we won't talk about how many years ago that was. I don't feel like it was very long. But even not that long ago, this isn't a term that I felt was being very emphasized, which is okay. We all evolve, we learn and grow. But it's a term that's been around since the 1990s. It was coined by a sociologist, Judy Singer. It's evolved to include autism and other developmental differences like ADHD, as well as mental health needs like anxiety. And the idea is that neurologic differences like autism and ADHD are the result of normal, natural variation in the human genome. So that as our brains have evolved, they have diversified, they've become different. And this is the natural evolution of that. So it's not that there is a disability or a difference. It's just a diverse exploration of all the elements of our brain. And of course, that looks different when we're looking at the DSM, the classification of autism. There's more challenges that are associated with that variety. But neurodiversity looks at how it's important to respect and understand diverse brains to help them fit into a world and also shape the world to help fit them.
I love that second point of also, I think from, I also feel similarly in that neurodiversity was not as talked about. There was a lot of acceptance and a lot of different things, but this more of making the world and other environments fit the client is where it just feels so powerful to be coming along, making that full circle rather than just serving half of that kind of circle.
Absolutely. And we have kind of coined an approach to that called the cross-section of neurodiversity. Now, I don't think we invented the wheel here. I think this is a theory that has probably existed, but my team member, Ava Marvin, created this visual for it, and it's now what we use in all our neurodiversity trainings. So looking at two arrows that cross over each other when we're thinking about neurodiversity. And the first arrow represents that validity and necessity for treatment or therapeutic intervention. And this tends to be where therapy lives, right? Where therapists live. We're looking at each client's areas of needs, setting goals, and creating therapeutic music experiences to reach functional skill change. So that's arrow one. We know that we want to empower this individual to be able to lead their most optimal life, to be able to lead their most independent life. But when we're looking at neurodiversity, the second arrow, this cross section, is really important. And the second arrow represents the respect for that person and their needs as a neurodiverse individual, respecting and recognizing their sensory needs, their modes of communication, their strategies used for emotional expression, and most importantly, what goals they want to reach. And I feel like that's not something that's maybe emphasized when we're in that driver's seat of therapy, to not just be looking at how can we change, but how can we also empower and support. So arrow one is changing the client to fit the environment. But arrow two, that's equally as important, is changing the environment to fit that client, because we can do both in the therapy sphere, and we have the ability to impact the world in a larger context than just the client in front of us.
Yes, that's so, so powerful of how, just how we can, I feel like that is affecting change, not just at an individual level, but affecting change, just ripple effect, you know, that's just going to continue to go and grow.
Yes. And it sounds beautiful, and we know it's not easy, that we want to create systematic change of social systems, of school systems, of work environments for individuals. But this is where it starts, is if you have therapists who are empowering that person to advocate for themselves in that environment, or being able to advocate for them and show the power that neurodiversity has in those environments.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. I love that. So with neurodiversity, I love that you just said the power of neurodiversity and twice exceptional. You had mentioned that earlier of people who are twice exceptional. So what kind of strengths do you often see like in the music therapy room, or how, what does that look like as you were just kind of saying, how we can maximize on the strengths of neurodiversity and within our sessions, and then also changing that on kind of that bigger scale. What does that look like? Or maybe there's an example that you can think of if that's easier too.
Yeah, absolutely. Kind of both. So yeah. We use a strengths-based approach in our practice. So looking at what skills our clients have, like you said, what is something they bring to the table that then we can use as the vehicle for change in their areas of need that we want to improve upon. So oftentimes we see in our space, I'll see really strong motor skills, but a lot of sensory dysregulation. So they have the ability to complete the motor movements that might help regulate themselves, but they haven't been taught self-regulation strategies in a way that's accessible for them. So that could mean we create a musical workout routine to help regulate the brain and body to be able to do higher order cognitive processes or to get our communication connectors going. We see a lot of that. I also see a lot with my clients who are ASD1 or lower need autism is really powerful auditory processing skills, but struggle with auditory attention and eliminating the distractors, right? There's so much happening in their brain that overwired areas of the brain are constantly firing. They're constantly hearing every noise, but that gives them the ability to retain information given in an auditory format really well. So for us, we do a lot of song creation and musical mnemonic devices to teach skills through those auditory pathways. Since they're so strong, I can teach you about tuning out the noise, or teach you about self-reg strategies, or teach you about executive function skills through creating a song around it. Because when I come back to you in 6 months and you tell me, and this is a direct client example, and you tell me, you know, this pandemic's really hard and I'm having a really difficult time and school stinks, right? All the things we're all feeling. One of my clients is telling me about their day and we're checking in and kind of creating the plan. And he just looks up at me on Zoom and goes, "Can't control that." And it's a song about our sphere of control, our locus of control, things that we can and can't manage, things that we can change inside ourselves and things we can't. And he knew right away everything he was talking about was something he has no control over, right? We have no control over this pandemic. And that song was just in his brain. He was able to retrieve it right away. And all the time that client will quote songs back at me when I'm giving them an example of something. And I'm like, yeah, you're right. That song's great for this. I didn't even think of that.
Oh my gosh. And what a powerful, you know, internal self-regulation system to be. I mean, adults have a hard time to, you know, in that, I think it's called the worry tree, you know, where it's like you go and it's like, here's this problem. Can I do anything about this problem? Is it hypothetical? Is it real? Yep. Is it within my circle of control or no? Yep. And, you know, for him to so quickly, he or she or whoever, for them to so quickly be able to be like, out of my control, you know, that's immediately of like, you know what, okay, it's there and it sucks, but it's out of my control. Where can I put that energy instead? I can put it into playing a song. Right. I can put it into like directly into something else within a session too.
Absolutely. And they often will write songs too about the challenges they do face having autism, which I love, to empower them in that modality that's effective for them. That same client wrote a song called The Power of Autism, talking about all the things that make him special having autism. Like he learned to read when he was 3 years old. He hears every sound in music and can have a powerful experience you might not be able to have, which was really cool to talk about all the things that they can do that our brains can't because they're different. And to have that always playing in their minds, right? Have that internal regulator just there. Yeah, it'd be so cool to have as an adult.
Yes. And like that fallback of, I mean, I feel that's just such a fantastic like self-esteem builder, confidence builder of, you know, being able to like have those, like a song like that of like, no, this is my Power of Autism song of like that when I'm feeling down or like if it's like that self-critic or that negative talk comes in, literally, especially as an auditory person, then to be like, you know, Power of Autism, you know, like I can do this and I can do that and I can do these things. And that's such a just a huge, huge like impact on a child's well-being, their mental health.
Yeah, absolutely. And mental health plays a huge role in autism too. I think that fits into that neurodiversity puzzle piece that we can't neglect the social emotional welfare of children or individuals with neurodiversities because it's still an important part. The research shows us that 80% of individuals with autism have anxiety symptoms, right? They may not be able to diagnose due to the way we diagnose those types of needs, often being verbal testing, and a lot of individuals with autism may be non-speaking, but 80%, I mean, anxiety and mental health is still a huge thing we need to be addressing in the world of autism and neurodiversity as a whole.
Can you say that one more time, like scream it from the rooftops for everyone in the back?
I can sing it from the rooftops, right? We need to be addressing mental health.
Oh my, I'm not sure there can be anything more like to tug at my heartstrings than that, because I think it's like just the experience that children who are neurodiverse, what they're experiencing and living in a world that is not set up for them, like hopefully one day we could get there. But that in itself is such a huge hurdle that the average person isn't going through, on top of things like dealing with, you know, lighting that is really uncomfortable and that's like making your amygdala go off of like, this isn't safe because these lights are fluorescent, and that's just how their body takes that information in. But that is really significant to someone's, you know, mental well-being, like you're saying. And we have so much responsibility to be addressing that and saying it out loud and talking about it in our sessions. There's just so much there.
Yeah, absolutely. And it can't be neglected. And especially during this pandemic, when families were coming to us, they're like, I don't know how to teach them about what's happening. And I'm like, well, if it's too hard to comprehend what's happening, because for all of us, it has been hard to understand what's happening, right? And we've all had different levels of processing. Let's get to the root. What are the presenting problems, quote unquote, that we're seeing and how can we address those? And often it's mental health and it's anxiety and it's self-regulation tools that they need to manage their emotions around it. And then we can label those feelings and we can start to process through this experience together. But how can we support you? Just because you have autism doesn't mean you're not capable or worthy of mental health support.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. Yes, 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 yes. Something that totally blew my mind, and I think this is probably something that's different in each state, but especially for children, different like waivers or insurance types of waivers for children who have special needs, or if they're on the autism spectrum, neurodiverse, they're like the support was, you know, kind of the classic OTPT speech, behavioral therapy, and then music or massage and different things like that. But I was just always so confused about like, well, where is the support for mental health if they need it? Like, why isn't there access to like play therapy? And, you know, many times music therapists can support that if they have a specialty in that, or if they have that training. But what about like supporting their mental health? Because why can't they have that option if they need it?
Right. Mm-hmm. Right. We're not limited to just, you know, ABA tends to be kind of the gold standard when people are getting their autism diagnosis of the first therapy they look at, which we're not here on this podcast to talk about that right now. That's a separate episode if we want to discuss different therapies. I don't have any strong opinions I need to share at the moment. but families are like, okay, where do I get an ABA therapist? And not saying that that may not be what your child needs, but why don't you first start, you know, assessing what styles of therapy can support the needs that are presented in front of you for that child, not just what this one data sheet says to do.
Yes. And for parents too, like it is so, I can't imagine of going through that process of getting the diagnosis and then like, where do I go? Mm-hmm. And it does feel like ABA is kind of like the first stop. It's like, oh, this is where, whether it's being directed or from like a sheet like that.
Right.
But it's just, I don't know if it's more advocacy too, of there's so much more and every child is different and it's going to be, you know, it could look very, very different for every child.
Exactly. And that's the beauty of neurodiversity. I want to be clear that I'm not saying any type of therapy is bad. I think everyone has the style that's going to work for them or work for their child. But in neurodiversity, there's so many different treatment approaches to therapy that you have to find the modality that works for you. And I mean, I think music therapy allows you to incorporate a lot of those different things. I mean, I wrote a blog post on this years ago about getting the biggest bang for your buck. And I would argue that creative arts therapists give you the most bang for your buck because we can access so many different clinical domains, right? We can access social, emotional, motor, physical, sensory, communication, cognition. Depending on your training and your advanced degrees, you can really tap into the brain and access these children in a way that no other modality can, and create a comprehensive experience that's both effective and empowering at the same time.
Yes, that empowering, like it's effective, it's empowering. And in that empowerment is like, this is a coping skill in itself.
Yeah.
It's a creativity outlet, self-expression. All of those things are so beautiful for well-being, you know, and it's dually doing that while working towards significant goals.
Exactly. And for children, it's fun. I steered away from that for so long, thinking, well, if they think music therapy is fun, then I'm just fun music lady, right? Mm-hmm. And it stinks that that might be a perception, but the fact that our therapy is fun makes it so much cooler, right? Kids want to come. They want to do the work, and it doesn't feel like work to them. They're learning tangible skills in a really engaging way. Based in science, it's not magic. We know why it's happening, which is so great for us, but they get to just have a really fun experience by themselves or in a social group, what have you. I steered away from the fun aspect for so long, and I'm like, no, the fact that we are fun is the best part about us.
Totally. Yes. Yeah. I mean, if I thought about, you know, going to like my therapist, and it's like, if I didn't enjoy it, I would be like, I just don't want to go. Like, I don't, I'm not motivated. I don't want to think about what they said last week. Like, I don't, you know, it's, and to think of that in a kid's shoes, especially in a kid's shoes, like if they don't want to do it, they're not going to do it. Like yep. sometimes all of the convincing in the world, like we could do that more as adults, but right. when it's fun and motivating and they look forward to it, especially, I think those goes right back to that relationship piece.
Yeah.
This is an adult that cares about them and that is human with them. And that is creating and holding space for them. What a resiliency factor for them, as well as being fun. Right. Like it's yeah. like just, it's explosive. It's amazing.
Absolutely. And as teenagers, like what you just summarized, I feel like when we're serving teenagers, they might think we're cool, right? I feel like that might be how teenagers describe that kind of relationship. mm-hmm. But it's like, it's not that we're cool. It's that we have complete space for you and you know that we're caring and thinking about you always in that moment. And you get to do something that's fun, right? We get to songwrite music videos, whatever that intervention strategy is to reach your goals. They have that strong relationship with you and you always holding that space for them. Absolutely. I feel like we don't always get thought of for teenagers because they think music therapy and like, oh, you're shaking jingle bells and you're playing drums. And yep. like, yep, I do. I do that a lot. Not gonna lie. But I also do a lot of creating songs in GarageBand or doing piggyback songwriting to process through events in your life and manage anxiety and manage these moments. And it looks a lot different for every client. But at the end of the day, absolutely, it's that driver space and you holding space for them in that session and in that moment.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, that's so, so beautifully said. So for therapists, like what kind of, when they're trying to approach neurodiversity in this human way, and we've kind of touched on some of the ethical, you know, a little bit of that ethical mm-hmm. way, what kind of supports can therapists be using or what can they be doing? I'm thinking like a lot of therapists are going to be like, well, how do I go about doing this in a session?
Yes.
What would you say to that?
Well, I always love to give takeaways and tangibles. So I'm totally in support of that.
Takeaways and tangibles. Ooh.
Takeaways and tangibles.
Yes. That's a nice little, like, that just has a ring to it. I love it.
I love alliteration too. All of our classes, like we have mini music makers.
Totally.
We love an alliteration at Dynamic.
Yeah, I think music therapists have a soft spot for that for sure. Like there's something poetically musical about it.
Or puns plays on things. We have a new group called Power Dynamics and we're Dynamic Links. We have Little Links, like our little group. So always playing on things.
Oh, puns are the best.
Puns are the best.
I'm there.
But I digress. I think a good takeaway and tangible number one is to always start with that cross-section of neurodiversity. And that goes into the ethics. But thinking about when you're trying to bring an intervention to the table, one, what is the validity and necessity for this? And two, is this respecting the personhood of the individual in front of me? And some additional questions you can ask yourself, how do I do this, is what does the client need to empower themselves? So if the goal right now is to support the client in front of us first in the goal of necessary treatment, what do they need to do that? And what kind of strengths-based approaches can you bring to the table? If that client loves Thomas the Train, right, and that's a strength of theirs, how can I incorporate that preferred item, that strength, to reach the goal we're looking for? Second, why are you writing the goal? What is the functional purpose? And that's something we really want to think to ourselves. I find myself years into practice, you'd kind of pull from the same bucket of goals and objectives. Not that they're not valid for the person in front of you, but why? Really think about your transfer to the real world and why are you working on the skill? How is it going to support the person towards their goals and supporting the society around us in this person living a functional, hopefully independent life and prosperous life? An example I had from a BCBA I'm friends with is make sure there's two ways that that goal can be applied in a real world setting. So if your goal is to work on a common one we used to see in schools is money transfer, right? I know, Kate, you worked in schools. Mm-hmm. I would see all the time people have money exchange goals, which is not bad, but just thinking about why are you writing this? I don't know about you. I haven't exchanged money with a human. Now, in the pre-COVID times, because I know in COVID, cash is not preferred. But in the pre-COVID times, haven't really exchanged money a whole bunch. I use my debit card. I have a bank account. So is the goal, the purpose of this goal, to be able to independently manage your banking situation? Then changing that objective to be more specific to the functional purpose. So same in the music therapy setting. Why are we working on this goal? If we're working on attention, is it because we want to appease the people around the individual, or are we supporting that individual so they can attend for a longer duration, so they can stay on task, so they could attend college to help with note taking, right? What is your long-term why for these little puzzle pieces we're putting together? And then also, who does it benefit? So this is where you're thinking, am I solely changing the client to fit the environment, or could I change an element of the environment to fit the person in front of us? And that who is important, and I find the hardest, because in some instances, our only option is to write the goal to change the person in front of us because the society at large isn't ready to change, but it's something that could so easily be changed, right? Personally, I will never, and I'm stating this in words now that'll be documented forever, I will never write a goal about changing self-stimming or eye contact, right? And I hope that those listening will also not do that, because science shows us with eye contact that doesn't make any difference in attention, right? We don't need to make eye contact with someone to be attending to them. And sometimes for individuals with autism and other neurodiversities, it can even be painful to sustain eye contact. Right. So who are we writing that goal for is a question to ask yourself. I had a parent request that as a goal, and I said, well, what is the goal? Are we trying to sustain attention, engage in conversational exchanges back and forth? Okay, great. Let's write those goals, because yes, that's important to have meaningful two-way communication and to sustain attention for the duration of a task. But is you keeping eye contact with me for a minute really a functional goal? Who's that for? So things like that, where I'd rather change the environment than change the person, or hand flapping or stimming. I am never going to write a goal around that. Now, if it's a self-stim behavior that is dangerous or harmful, right? Sometimes it could be headbanging or biting. Mm-hmm. I do maybe want to find a replacement for that that effectively meets their sensory needs, but keeps them from being a risk of danger to themselves or others, because we want to keep the person safe. So always thinking, who is this really for? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Those are so wonderful. I love that you painted those pictures so beautifully so that you can really see how those things look, especially, you know, kind of imagining that example with the mom, you know, yeah. saying like, I want this eye contact. And those can be hard conversations mm-hmm. to navigate with parents, with administration, you know, if you're in an IEP meeting, those aren't always the most fun, and, you know, and kind of traversing some of those things can be very difficult. But that it's coming down to the, you know, the most basic human, like just human decency of why would I have a child try to meet this goal of staring at me when it could be painful for them? And it's not really doing anything after that. Like where does that go after that? Yeah. Right. Yeah.
Right.
It feels flimsy.
And what role does eye contact play in conversational exchange? Is it I look at you to make sure you're listening to me and then I look away? None of us are just staring at each other for the duration of a conversation, right? That would be ridiculous. People would be like, are you okay?
We're not doing that now.
Right. Oh, definitely.
We're only doing this by audio. So then it's like, well.
Exactly. And I would say, I don't know if you've seen the same thing for your clients. I guess this is sort of a side tangent.
Yeah. But
Zoom has been, in some instances, not in all, a more effective therapeutic modality because the pressure of the social exchange is eliminated and we're just in that screen, right?
Yep.
And I don't know the long-term good or bad implications of that. None of us do. There'll be research for many years to come. But my personal experience with my clients, they have been able to thrive in online school. They've been able to have more effective social relationships because they're learning exchange systems on chat, and they don't have to worry about, am I reading their body language right? Am I doing this? They're engaging just in that verbal communication, and they've been able to develop friendships in a new way. They've been able to sustain attention in class more effectively. They're getting their work done on time. They don't have all the auditory distractions of the traditional classroom environment. I mean, some of my families are like, we're doing this forever. Like, yeah. We're never going back.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. I have had a similar experience. And I also, to say even farther before that, before March, I was like, I think, I don't know about teletherapy with, you know, like, I was coming from my own viewpoint of being a, you know, mid-30s, did not grow up with, you know, technology until in college. Yeah. And so it just hasn't been a part of, it's not as, you know, ingrained, I think, in me. And I completely was completely disregarding children's experience who have always grown up with it. It's a part of their life so much more than it ever was like for me. I completely looked over that and looked over the things like you just said of like, this is a flat screen. Like you can, there's so much less to pick up in that. And that's less pressure, which can be, it can give you more time and more energy to focus on other things.
Absolutely. And I mean, the one client I was referring to too with the auditory processing, this was the client I mentioned way back when we were talking about the power of autism too, that in a traditional learning environment completely has the cognitive abilities to be in the mainstream classroom. But due to auditory overload, it's too chaotic of an environment for this client. So they didn't really have a way to support him. And they just put him outside in the hallway to do work because it was quieter. And I can't speak to good or bad in that situation because they're trying to do what they felt the most effective. But now he can be part of the classroom experience without being in the noise of the classroom experience. And what a great tool to change the environment to support the individual versus eliminating the individual from the environment to support them. Yeah.
Yes. And I think there's something too about the element of you're literally physically like in your safe space, you know, that then it's like, okay, if this becomes too much, I can literally walk away and take a break versus when you're in somewhere that is like, you know, obviously like school or some of those places are safe, but they're not like home safe, you know, where you're like, oh, okay, I can really let down my guard, you know?
Right.
And so there's like this element of extra safety, felt safety when you're at home from a computer versus when you're in, you're kind of on the spot and that can be more anxiety producing.
Absolutely. And you have things that might not be socially acceptable at home, squishy stuffed animals that maybe a 10, 11-year-old isn't allowed, I don't want to say allowed, but expected to bring to school. And now this client can keep that on their lap and squish it so that it's not visually distracting, but they can give that sensory supports that they need in a way that there's completely zero judgment because no one can see you.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. I love that too. Of like, no joke. I usually keep what's it called? It's the block with like the light switch and the little buttons on it.
Oh, a fidget cube.
A fidget cube. Yeah. I have one of those and I use it all the time.
Yep.
And I love it. It is, and I could, cause it's the same thing. I can do it under the desk. They're quiet. Nobody. And it's like, man, I could not use these in sessions before. This is amazing.
Yep. Yep. I am a big proponent of using sensory tools in session, just personally. Back when I was in person, we have a sensory squish bin that clients can choose from. And we reflect on what's supporting us and what's not. With that same client, you know, last week they brought a football action figure to session. And I was like, whoa. I was like, that's real cool. But it looks like it's distracting more than helping you focus. What do you think? And they were like, yeah, like, well, let's pick something else. So we do the same with our sensory squish bin. And we try to, you know, hone in on what tool is really helping us focus the most. And then I'll also use a tool and like model that look, I can talk with you. I can still engage in what we're doing, but I have this tool to keep my brain really focused, to keep my hands busy if they start to get distracted. So I love sensory tools in session. I say, go for it, Kate, bring your fidget cube. Do
oh my
it.
Gosh. Mm-hmm. I know I should like half the time I should just like show it and model it of like, this is what I use.
Yeah, I love it. It's great.
Yes.
I'm a putty gal. I am a deep pressure squish gal. But everyone's different. This particular client loves the like marble fidget. It almost looks like it's in a finger trap. If you guys listening have never seen those, really fun one to try out with your clients. Really good back and forth. And they actually started using it at school in the pre-COVID times. Because it was so effective for them to stay on task, stay on target, and so small and subtle that it wasn't distracting to themselves or anyone in the room.
Yes.
Yeah.
That is fantastic. And then, you know, I think we've come a long way. Like, thank goodness for the craze of fidget spinners. Like, I know there were, it was pretty yeah. over the top for a while, but yeah. I think it also paved the way for parents and, you know, more acceptance to have fidgets. And right. that, like, I was talking to one of my friends and she was explaining to me, she was like, you know, one of my kiddos just, she's always moving and she's always, you know, fidgeting and literally just looks uncomfortable when she's like sitting in her Zoom sessions. I was like, why don't you just give her like a rubber band or something to fidget with? And she was like, what? Like, and I was like, yeah, of course. And she was like, oh my gosh, I don't know. You know, like I just hadn't thought of that before. And it's really amazing just what one small thing that you can kind of pour that excess energy into, whether it's anxiety, if it's just energy from like ADHD, if it's focus, whatever it is, it can just really ground you so, so much.
Right. And what you just said too, celebrating neurodiversity means allowing for more freedom of that in the environment, right? To support the individual. Mm-hmm. Kids were not meant to sit in a classroom for 8 hours a day. And I understand the validity and necessity of that. But when you're looking at the cross section, who are the children in front of you and what do they need, right? Do they need right now to get up and move their bodies? Do they need a clicky pen break? We had those when I was in high school, or if the teacher started to hear us all click our pens too much, like, all right, 10 second clicky pen break, go. And everybody's clicking their pens as fast as they can for 10 seconds.
Oh my gosh, I love that.
Right. And it's something so simple that it's just, all right, get it out. Let your energy out. Take a break off what I'm talking about for 5 seconds, because our brains can only attend for so long. For every minute of age, that's about how long our brains can attend for. So a 14-year-old is not attending to your 1 hour lecture. It's just not the case. So you have to give them time to check out, check in, and effective strategies to do so, because you don't want them to miss anything. But our brains are also only able to do so much. And when we're looking at diverse brains, they're able to do different things for different lengths of time based on their areas of need and their areas of strength. So you really have to respect the person in front of you and engage them in a way that's effective for them. Now, that's a huge challenge for educators who are seeing 30 children at one time. And how do I effectively engage 30 different brains? Because that's what you have in front of you. We're all neurodiverse. How do I engage them, keep them on task, meet their sensory needs, meet their social needs, help them emotionally express? I mean, we ask a huge job of educators. So if you're an educator listening, I also have a degree in education. I applaud you. It's a hard job that you do, that we do. And they need more support as well to be able to support all the different brains in their room, whether that be sensory areas or break areas or social emotional systems, so that they have more tools they can implement and teach children to implement themselves. Again, empowering that individual in an effective way to meet the neurodiverse needs, because one person can't do it. We have to teach them how to help and advocate for themselves.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, that is so, so powerful. So, so well said, especially with teachers, man, this year, teachers, anyone who's a teacher who's listening, like, you're a savior. Yeah. This, oh man. Yeah. And then I love how you had said it's 30 different brains right. in your classroom. You know, that element of, we are all neurodiverse and all of our brains work differently. Yep. And, you know, we have different things that we have strengths at and different things that are a little bit more difficult for us. Right. And that's a hard task to do with 30, you know, with 30 different kids. But thinking about, you know, especially I think when then you reduce that down to, as a therapist in an individual session, of like, we can do that. You know, we can yes. do that with one, even if we have a group of three, you know, like spending that time. I think you mentioned also just respect, the element of respecting someone else, as this is another human being who deserves my utmost respect no matter what. Yep. And how do I make that happen in the session to maintain that connection and get their needs met?
Absolutely. And I think there needs to be moments of that in inclusion more. And that's something we're looking at Dynamic Links, is how do we create a workshop for schools where children can support the neurodiversity within their peer group? Because in those unstructured moments, I think the social emotional struggles and the social skill differences really limit the acceptance of neurodiversity? And how are we teaching that inclusion in the unstructured environment as well? Of how do I support and respect the person in front of me? Because we're just different. Our brains are just different. And that doesn't mean I have to be best friends with that person, but eventually you'll find your best friend, right? We all have different interests, different ways our brain works. So creating those unstructured moments of positive social interaction is going to be really powerful long term, especially when we're seeing 1 in 6 children has some form of disability now. And that's a wide range of disability. I believe visual impairments are included in there. So if you wear glasses, you technically fit that category. So it's large. And I feel like that number might sound really big, but there's so many neurodiverse children interacting with one another. How do we teach them that respect for the personhood in front of them and shifting their reaction or their environment a little bit to be more supportive of the individual in front of them? Because I don't know about you, but all my clients are pretty awesome and fantastic kids. Yeah, right. They really, I don't have any kid that I'm like, oh man, I totally would have been friends with you. You know, like I totally would have been friends with all of them. Mm-hmm. And they just need... peers need to learn a little bit more about neurodiversity too, because we need to shift that environment to meet the individuals we're supporting there. So, you know, that's the next step and that's a more global issue, but I'd love to find like a therapy workshop we could present around the country to be like, here is how you create more inclusive spaces in a natural and fun way.
What a powerful, powerful idea. I can't wait because that's going to happen.
All right. Nobody else steal it. Copyright.
No. Yeah, copyrighted 2020. That is so – there's that. I think there's just so much weight in that and so beautifully said. And what an amazing idea too of – We can't just support children of neurodiversity and expect that to work, but right. This is a global thing. Like this mm-hmm. is everybody needs to get in the table on this one, right. You know, of like, this is how this works. And I do think of course modeling, you know, but there's only so much modeling we can do as adults who, you know, even if like, I remember in schools doing social groups where, you know, it was an inclusive classroom setting and doing social groups like that. But I only get an hour, you know, and I can model all of the respect and all of those different things to support neurodiversity, but that doesn't happen all the time. And every kid's not going to pick it up off of an hour. And right. There's just so much work that needs to be done behind that. That would just be such a powerful, I could see that as like motivational speakers coming into schools and, yeah. You know, different things like that. That would be so, so wonderful.
Yeah. I think of it as those people who came in for like assemblies. I don't know if you had them as a kid, yeah. But they would do puppet shows and all those things. And there was always a life lesson behind it being like that. And then leaving the school with worksheets and tangibles and follow-up activities that they should be doing to reemphasize what we taught in that short workshop.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And to circle back, I think one of the things that there's so much basis on, especially for kids, I think this is just something in my experience that has always been like an intriguing moment, is, you know, the strengths-based approach of yeah. like, oh, well, you know, Sammy is, you know, oh, Sammy, yeah, he's on the autism spectrum, but did you know that Sammy can do this really cool thing with music where he can play this thing back really quickly? Yeah. And like other kids are like, wait, what? Right. And then it's just like this instant moment of connection. And I think there's something really powerful in that strengths piece of like, there's so much more going on than you realize.
Absolutely. And in the world of disability, not everyone presumes competence. So they'll think in your example, oh, because Sammy maybe is non-speaking or Sammy struggles to engage with us socially, that Sammy is not a sentient, competent being. And mm-hmm. that individual absolutely is. Sometimes it's just showing where their strengths lie to say like, this is a person who has feelings and thoughts and ideas and wonderful things to say. And it's sad that we have to do that, but I think it's a good start in saying, this is a human, this is an amazing human in front of you who has different challenges than you, but also has different capabilities than you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes, I love that. I love that so much. And I think that goes for every single child. There's so many, I just did a presentation with Music for Kiddos, their symposium, which was amazing, about respect and about like asking for permission to touch.
Yeah.
You know, if thinking about children who might be like in a wheelchair and are limited with their mobility or limited with their communication, but still doing everything that you would, or even going the extra mile of, you know, asking for permission to touch, asking for permission in general, even if the communicative response might not be there yet, it's still like that's bringing in that respect and just bringing that to every single child.
Absolutely. If we have mobility device users, we always teach everyone around us that you have to ask before you touch their device. You have to ask if they want to be pushed to dance, if you want to dance with them. That's just like their body. You have to ask if they want you in that personal bubble space or not. Absolutely.
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, I love that. Well, obviously you're very passionate about social emotional skills within music therapy too.
Yeah.
Do you have like favorite ways that you like to support those skill sets in your sessions, or, you know, something that you have found that works really well? I know it's very different with every session, but what's some of your favorites?
Sure. So I think like my favorite to start with that kind of encompasses neurodiversity and then the social emotional component too is the DIR, floor time, developmental levels, the developmental period and pyramid and ladder. So that first step on the ladder is looking at regulation and shared attention. So if you have a client who is neurodiverse, who's struggling with social emotional expression, this may be the root. So I like the way it moves up the ladders because you can look at the root cause of what's the presenting problem in front of you. So you have regulation and shared attention, which goes up to engagement with others, then two-way purposeful communication, shared social problem solving, creation of ideas, and finally logical thinking. So you can kind of root down to what areas of need as we build up through that pyramid are kind of missing for that client that's making it harder for them to be emotionally expressive or to communicate with others or engage in those social skills. Because it's not always step four, shared social problem solving. It could be that they struggle with self-regulation, so they can't engage in that as effectively as they could if they were regulated and able to attend to the given situation. So I love that framework. It's not necessarily just social emotional, but to drill down into what area can you target as a therapist to empower that individual.
Oh, I love that. And DIR floor time is just so, so cool. That and to have kind of like, I like that there's that stepwise element to that too. What a great framework. I think as a therapist, sometimes having a framework to lean on instead of like going into the ambiguous space of like feelings and emotions and how do we work on this and kind of having that skill strand in a way.
Yes. Yeah. And it's based off of Maslow's hierarchy of needs, which I feel like has been circulating in this pandemic time a lot right now, that we're not meeting those basic needs, we're not optimally performing at the top, right? Theoretically, as adults who have jobs and homes and families, we've reached that, you know, esteem and self-actualization tier of Maslow's hierarchy of needs. However, if we're struggling with our mental health, if we're struggling with our executive functioning, if we're struggling with day-to-day tasks, it's likely because those lower levels of the pyramid aren't being fulfilled. We're not meeting our basic needs, we're not meeting our social needs, and then we're not meeting our own emotional needs. So we're not at the point of self-actualization. We're really just kind of floating up there trying to get by, but we need to root down to the basics to fulfill ourselves so we can stay at that top tier.
Yes, yeah. So important. I love that. It's such a great visual too, to fall back on, to kind of bring that to the forefront.
Takeaways and tangibles.
I love it. Takeaways and tangibles.
You need them. I'm a visual learner for everyone listening, if you couldn't tell. I like pictures, right? That's why I'm painting the pictures. I need to understand what are you talking about? What can I go Google? What was that thing she said? You can Google all those. The images will show up for you. I promise it's what I said. And then my other favorite tool I use in session is the social thinking zones of regulation curriculum. And I was tentative to use these in practice because I felt like as a music therapist, I really had to make everything myself, which is silly because then you never have time to do anything ever. Right. Mm-hmm. So I like those strategies, you can really pull them in a creative way to your sessions. We do a lot of songwriting work with them. We do a lot of instrument exploration with them, labeling our emotions, them being, sorry, the unthinkables and the thinkables from Superflex, and labeling who are these things that are taking over our brain and who are these things that make it hard to listen or stay focused or what's that anxiety flaring inside me. I like the way they create words around it. That's not negative. It's just saying this is what takes over and that's okay. But what strategies can we use to stop them? So that's another one of my favorites that we use a lot. I think it's totally okay to pull in evidence-based social emotional curriculum. Just remember how you're using it as a music therapist, right? What's your scientific logic? What's your therapeutic logic? And what's your musical logic and how you're delivering it? And then it's not just music in therapy, but really music as the therapy using that systematic framework that already exists. You don't have to reinvent the wheel.
Yes. And that, like, why wouldn't we lean on those things, you know, and bring those in? And I think that is the beauty of music, is that it's so adaptable. And I really think kind of the, you know, one of the thrones that we have as music therapists is we can take different theories, figure out how to use music, adapt it, create it, whatever it is, and blend it into this wonderful intervention that can serve all of those things. And, you know, it, why not bring in all of – I think that that's why I'm so passionate about bringing play therapy techniques into music therapy. Because it's like, these are fantastic, and they're so easily plugged into music therapy. So, you know, utilizing some of those things to the best of your ability and your training and all of that stuff, and it's just beautiful things can come from that.
Absolutely. I think there's so much magic and power in collaboration and cross modalities, just remembering how you're delivering it and what makes you unique as the deliverer, as a music therapist, when you're in the driver's seat, just using those tools that you have. Absolutely.
So beautifully said. Oh my gosh, I love it. Well, okay. On that note, I'm going to go with that pun. So this has been so wonderful. And I want to make sure that listeners can find you and reach out to you, which I encourage you listeners to do. Where are some places that our listeners can find you and follow you?
Sure, absolutely. You can find me on Instagram, where they're every day, Dynamic Links, LYNKS. You can also find us on dynamiclinks.com. We have a free resource portal on there. So dynamiclinks.com/resources will take you to loads of free ideas. I promise there's no hidden fees, no nothing. You put your email in and you have access to a whole Google Drive of social emotional strategies, autism strategies, all those goodies. Where else can you find us? That's pretty much it, but you can email me personally, info@dynamiclinks.com or Alyssa@dynamiclinks.com. Happy to talk more. I do clinical supervision. So if you're struggling with neurodiverse clients, I absolutely love supporting therapists who are in kind of a rut with that and helping you look at your clients in a new way. So even if you just have a question, email me. I'm not going to charge you for a question, but I'd love to connect with our autism community within the music therapy world, our neurodiversity, mental health community, all of those things, because our power lies in connection, especially during these crazy times.
It does. We overlap. So let's like celebrate all of that space between. Yes.
Absolutely.
Awesome. Alyssa, thank you so, so much for coming on and just sharing your passions. I'm sure we'll do an episode again, and I just can't wait to see all the amazing things that you guys are going to do over there at Dynamic Links.
Thanks, Kate. Thank you so much for having me. This has been awesome.
Yes. All right. I hope you guys enjoyed that episode. If you couldn't tell, I just loved talking with Alyssa, and we both are pretty passionate about this topic, supporting neurodiverse and twice exceptional clients, especially in the realm of social emotional skills within relational therapy, I guess relationship-based therapies. And it was just awesome to hear what she's doing and to talk about it. So I hope that you guys enjoyed it. Next week, we will be on our quarterly mute. Our mute is in place every quarter so that we can create space as podcasters and as media. And I say we because there's a few other podcasts that do this as well. But It's really to create the space for you to take the time to listen to someone else talk about really important topics. And this is, I think we really kind of figured that this was the way to go about supporting others in our field in discussions and topics that they have to talk about, not only by just having people come on our show, which would be kind of centering the conversation on our platform, but really to turn our platform off and to lift up the other voices that are out there and the other platforms that are out there, so that their voices are heard, because it's really important that we do that. So that will be happening next week. So check out the show notes, because if you're looking for content to listen to, there will be a bunch of suggestions of different podcasts, videos, YouTube videos, different things like that, articles and things like that. And usually those are centered around diversity and inclusion. So definitely check those out and go follow those other platforms. And yeah, I think we're really happy to continue this process so that we can continue the work that doesn't end because 2020 ends. This is work that has to continually happen. So again, also, if you ever have constructive criticism, feedback, suggestions, anything that you want to share with us on the podcast, there is an anonymous survey in our show notes, and that is for you. Your voice is really important. If we missed the mark on something, if something insensitive was said or anything along those lines, I really want to know if that has happened and if I missed that. So that's why that survey is there. But again, you're always welcome to just reach out by shooting me an email. You can reach me at kate@creativetherapyumbrella.com, creativetherapyumbrella@gmail.com, a bunch of places, on Instagram as well. I absolutely love talking to people, talking to other creative arts therapists and expressive therapists. So please always feel free to reach out. But in other news, that's really it for us. This is the last episode of 2020. It's been a really long year. If you're on my newsletter, I just sent out something this week as well, about the end of the year. And there's a lot of growing, learning, reflecting, changing, a lot of things from this year. And I'm excited to continue to reflect and grow and learn and change and undo and continue that process. So, but we made it to the end of 2020. We're here. So it feels really good, and it feels like quite an accomplishment this year to get to this point. So I hope that you're able to celebrate. I hope that you are surrounded by your most near and dear. And I'm just sending you the most warm wishes. And I'm really excited to talk to you again in 2021. So take care and be creative.